The following talk was given by Dokai Georgeson at Dharma Field Meditation and Learning Center in Minneapolis on October 2, 2022. This talk may not be played or reproduced for profit.
Nice to see you all here this morning. So I want to give a brief introduction to our guest speaker this morning. If you're a regular attendee at Dharma Field, and it looks like a lot of you are, you've probably had the pleasure of hearing Dokai speak before. Dokai Georgeson is the guiding teacher at Hokyoji Zen Practice Community down in Aitzen, Minnesota, and he's joining us via Zoom, obviously. It looks like a lovely day down there in Aitzen right now. So Dokai is a Dharma sibling of Stephen Norm. He studied with Katagiri, and after he received a Dharma transmission from Katagiri, it looks like he continued his studies both in Japan and in Europe. So I don't know that I have much else to add here, Dokai. That's a pleasure to have you here. I'm glad I can see you, even if it's on a TV screen right now. But I'll take that. So welcome, and thank you.
Thank you, Steve. Can you hear everything going okay technologically? Hear me okay? All right, thumbs up, great. Seems like we always need to check that out. Well, originally I had intended to be in the with you in person, but a couple of weeks ago I was in Minneapolis for an event. And I really had trouble getting around. It's like, you know, I lived there for 20 years, but it's been 30 since I moved away. Minneapolis has changed a lot in 30 years, and I had a hard time. I mean, and it was dark and it was raining, and I have like trouble with my eyes these days. So I said, you know, I don't think I can do this. So I asked Steve if I could join by Zoom, and he said okay. So thank you for that. I'm going to talk today from I'm a little bit of an unusual Zen person in that I really appreciate the old, very, very old teachings of the Buddha. They're called in Pali, they're called the Nikayas. And most Zen teachers, I don't think, read much of the Nikayas. And so I just wanted to expose a little bit of that to you today. They're a little bit different kind of writings than most of our Zen writings. And I started reading them like when I was in my late 20s, and I remember being down in the office of MZMC, which was the only Zen center in town, and I was working on some project, and Katagiri Roshi came down, and Katagiri Roshi never talked about the Nikayas, no lecture that I ever remember. And so I asked him about it, and I said, you know, Hojo-san, I'm really appreciating these old writings of the Buddha. They're considered the oldest. And he looked at me, and he just said, yes, yes, we get a very human flavor from the Nikayas. And I think in the suttas I'm going to talk about today, we'll see a little bit of that. So sometimes you have to read long and hard to find something very interesting in the Nikayas. Now, I'm speaking from personal experience. You can spend like 4 hours reading, and then you get 2 minutes of stuff that really resonates with you. So they're not easy to read. But anyway, just moving on from that, I'll get started. One other introductory comment is we started doing Dharma Zoom talks, Zoom Dharma talks here at Hokyoji, you know, a year and a half ago, something like that. And we were thinking how to construct them. And I had the idea that no longer than 30 minutes, an in-person talk is, somehow we came up with this idea, I guess it was from Katagiri Roshi, that you had to talk for an hour, for a Dharma talk. And, you know, when I was growing up in my church, the pastor talked for 15 minutes, 20 max. If he went beyond 20, he was going to be in trouble next Monday morning. So I'm not quite sure how we all migrated from this 15, 20 minute talk to an hour long talk. It seems a little oppressive. So my talk, we'll see how it goes, but if I stop in 30 minutes, that's just because that's kind of getting to be my routine now. So here we go. Okay, the sutra I'm going to talk on is called the Bhaddhakaratta Sutta. And I might not be pronouncing that correctly, the Pali. And one translation of it is from Bhikkhu Bodhi, is one fortunate attachment. And another translation from Thich Nhat Hanh is our appointment with life. So here's how it begins. Thus have I heard, and that's Ananda. This is how most of these Nikayas begin. Ananda had a phenomenal memory, and he could remember the teachings. And in those days, they didn't write things down. It was just passed along by verbal connections. So on one occasion, the fortunate one was in Savatthi. There he addressed the practitioners thus. Dear practitioners. And they respond, Venerable Sir, they replied. And the fortunate one said this, I will teach you the summary and exposition of one who has one fortunate attachment. Listen and attend closely to what I will say. Yes, sir, the practitioner said. And this is what the fortunate one said. So what I'm going to be, I want you to hold this in your memory a little bit. I'm going to start out with a stanza that he gives, and I'll tell you when it's beginning, which is right now, and I'll tell you when it ends. Okay. The stanza says, let not a person revive the past or on the future build hopes. For the past has been left behind and the future has not been reached. Instead, with insight, let the practitioner see each presently arisen state. Let the person know that and be sure of it, invincibly, unshakably. Today the effort must be made. Tomorrow death may come, who knows? No bargain with mortality can keep it and its hordes away. But one who dwells thus ardently, relentlessly by day, by night, it is that person, the peaceful sage has said, who has one fortunate attachment. Now that's the end of the stanza. Just hold that in your mind. It's going to come back a few minutes later, I think. I read this sutta when I was like in my 30s, and I was really struck by it. And at that time, there weren't, and I actually read it in a wholly different, completely different translation, and there wasn't much commentary on the Nikayas when I was 30 years old. But now I've found many scholars and studiers of the Buddhist canon really regard this as one of the primary teachings. And it's kind of always a little satisfying when you kind of read something and, ooh, this one's really nice. And then later, like scholars, I mean, really important people say, yeah, this was really an important one. And I think the first thing that struck me is that I think maybe most of you have been practicing quite a while, or even maybe not so long, have heard the phrase, be here now. I think that's pretty common. Maybe it was coined by Ram Dass, I'm not sure. But, and you know, when I heard it, I thought, oh, this is brand new. But the Buddha was saying this 2,500 years ago. And is there anything else he's saying in this sutra except be here now? I'm not sure that he is. Now, we've all known that, you know, attachments aren't really a great thing to have if you're studying Buddhism. You know, we should watch them closely and try not to let them proliferate. But in this sutta, the Buddha said, it is one who does this practice who has one fortunate attachment. So this might be the only one fortunate attachment that there is in Buddhism. But it's fortunate in that we have taken up the practice of just trying to be present in this moment. And watching everything that arises and try not to get caught by that and try not to push it away or crave for whatever is arising. And I think this sutra is saying just exactly that. Another thing I'm going to keep in mind is that I'd like us to keep in mind. It says, today the effort must be made. So basically that means it's like right now. It's not like when you're doing zazen, you say, well, give me a few minutes to settle down, you know. And then the period goes by and then, oh boy, well, okay, I'll try better next time. It's like, just look at that scenario of where we're not now. I'm not, you know, I feel a little tired or whatever. There's always something that's sort of indicating, no, this isn't quite the right time to actually do this practice. So we really, I think that's especially important to keep in mind when we're doing zazen. Because the practice of zazen that we set up to do is designed to be the simplest practice we can do as human beings. The simplest activity. That's what I mean, the activity. Okay, we sit down and we look at a wall. That's it. Nothing more. We don't think about anything. We don't get up and dance around. We're just going to sit there and look at a blank wall in our tradition. Now, what else is more complicated of an activity for human beings than that? It's really not there. I mean, we could lay down and look at a blank ceiling. Maybe that would be simpler. But you all know what would happen if we did that as a practice. We would all just continuously fall asleep. So it's the simplest activity we can do as a human being. And yet, all of you have practiced, I'm sure, much zazen. And yet, there's something about it that's incredibly difficult. It's like, look how fast, how quickly our minds move from one place to another. because we're not actually satisfied with this moment as it is. There's something coming up within ourselves that is basically saying, this isn't enough. I mean, isn't that that's what my experience is when I'm sitting Zazen. It says, no, there's got to be something more than this. But there isn't. It's just this moment. And how do we settle ourselves right in this moment? If we can do that, we'll find that there's something really incredible that's happening just in this moment that we've had never had any idea about. But we do need to make the effort now. We need to go into that Zendo. And I'm just using the Zendo as an example, sitting Zazen, because it's the simplest thing. I mean, let alone washing dishes or brushing your teeth, then you really get into some complicated behaviors. But we're just trying to do Zazen, to sit there. Then there's a line that says, no bargain with mortality. And first time I read it, is it Catherine Kubler-Ross? Am I saying her name right? I think so. You know, she set up these five things when you're dealing with the end of your life. And one of them is bargaining. I remember that. And that was like, oh, okay, I'll take all my medicines. You know, and I'll get good doctors and, you know, I'll get over this thing. So we bargain. That's one of our stages in dealing with, you know, if we get a final diagnosis that you're not going to really be around a lot longer. I mean, it doesn't matter if we get that final diagnosis or not. We still we all have the final diagnosis right from the beginning. This life isn't going to last forever. But it's interesting for me that he says no bargain with mortality can keep its and its hordes away. Okay, I think that's all I'm going to say about that. And that's the stanza. Now, going to go into the exposition. So Buddha makes a little more, some more clarifying remarks about this stanza. He says, and how, practitioners, does one revive the past? Thinking I had such material form, such feeling, such perception, such formations, such consciousness in the past, one finds delight in that. That's how one revives the past. So, and the key here is thinking of these things, one finds delight. Now, there's different translations. I've studied this a little bit. And maybe we'll find out if I actually get all the way through that, is that what happens is in a later sutra where another person is, his name is Mahakashana, and this person had the special ability. Some of the Buddhist disciples were known for their special abilities. Ananda was known for his memory, and other people known for other things. And Mahakashana was known for his expanding in detail what the Buddha says in brief. So that was his specialty. So I'm just going to go to that right now, where he says, one gets bound up. That's what delight means. Our consciousness, our whatever things, we get bound up with things from the past and we start to crave for those experiences again. That's how we revive the past, and also how it's not so helpful for our practice. And I'm going on, I'm kind of really abbreviating because there's lots and lots of repetition here. That's how these old sutras do, and it doesn't work well for a verbal presentation. And how, practitioners, does one build up hope upon the future? Thinking, may I have such material form, feeling, perception, formations, and consciousness in the future. One finds delight in that. So it's imagining how things might be different in the past, in the future. And we kind of get bound up with that. I read something quite moving to me, and this was, I think I was just like in my mid-teens or something like this, and it actually struck a note of truth. I read like some kind of psychology thing where he says, young people look toward the future for their happiness. Old people look to their past. And something rung true with me, even reading that when I was like 15 years old. I knew it about myself. I'm saying, yeah, when I get out of school, I just get through this school thing, you know, I'll be happy. I got into college. Okay, I got to do this thing. But once I get out, I'll be free, something like that. It was always like you're always looking forward to something else in the future. And now I'm 71 years old, and I'm not doing that anymore. I'm saying, just wait till I'm 80. Isn't that going to be wonderful? So that's not happening so much. It's kind of like there's a proclivity to go back to imagine how things were, how I was a little happier in the past with different things. And then I'm going to go to the next passage, which says, and how, practitioners, is one vanquished in regard to presently arisen states? Here, practitioners, an ordinary person, regards material form as self, or self as possessed of material form, or material form as in self, or self as in material form. Now, this little kind of stanza or this passage comes out quite often in the Pali Canon, but it's just saying and I didn't say this, but maybe some of you caught on. The format that the Buddha is speaking of here is through the five skandhas, or five components of the personality of the person. Form, our material self, our feelings, our perceptions, our feelings, consciousness, and whatever the other one is. Formations. Kind of mental formations. It's a way by which the Buddha kind of broke down our idea of ourself, these things, because they're very important. Each one of them is very important to us. You know, you get stung by a bee. Oh, my body's hurting, something like that. So that becomes an important thing. So we identify with these five skandhas as being ourself. So, and then he states the opposites too, and I won't go through them. I'll just give one example, and it's just that we don't regard these things, or we are not. The difference is here is that we think of things from the past, or we think about things about the future, because we have to think about things in the future to make plans. That's necessary. And we do think about the past because we learn from the past. But it's the getting bound up by either one, or raising the expectations of the future, or getting caught and bound by the past. The difference is thinking of the past. How is one not, does not revive the past? Is we think of the past, but we're not getting bound up by it. It's just happened. It's over. And we move on. And we make plans for the future. But mostly not during Zazen. So that's our challenge. So our Zazen practice is just to take a certain amount of time each day, not a whole long time, hour, and just practice not making plans, not scheming for the future. So the Buddha finished his sermon, and this is what the fortunate one said. The bhikkhus were satisfied and delighted in the fortunate one's words. Now, that's the way most of the suttas end in the Pali canon, but every now and then somebody says, and this is why I like the human part of it too. Sometimes there's, right now I can think of two different responses besides this one. This is the most common. But sometimes the people, he's talking to person, this is usually a lay person when he's speaking to, and the person will say, oh, thanks a lot. You know, I'm really busy. I really appreciated your teaching, but I got to get going now. So that's one of the, sometimes that happens. Not a lot. And the other thing I was just reading again today, someone will say, he'll give a teaching and then someone's response will, like this, in this one sutra, this guy is leaning on a stick while the Buddha's teaching. And he's, after he's done, the person says, well, okay, so be it. And then he shakes his tongue, or does this with his head. And then he wags his tongue. So we can just imagine what that means. I'm not sure. But I think it, in our kind of, if we're, this is going to be my translation into our culture. It's going to be like, yeah. You're just a little bit off, but, you know, so be it. You know, I got to go now. I'm going my separate ways. So that doesn't happen very often, but every now and then. So I think we all have this idea that Buddha, you know, when he gave a sermon, you know, everyone was just awestruck by everything he said. But that wasn't always the case, according to my understanding. Now there's another sutta that follows this one, and it's exactly the same, except Ananda is giving the sermon on this. And the only reason I'm going to bring that up is because, and it moved me when I first read it too, is that Ananda gave the sermon. He came back to the Buddha and said, this is what I said. What do you think? And he says, that's just right, Ananda. That's exactly what I would have said. And the reason that was important to me at a certain time in my life, and still is that it's generally recognized that Ananda did not achieve full awakening during the Buddha's lifetime. It wasn't until afterwards. However, the Buddha's acknowledging, that's just exactly right, Buddha, Ananda. That's just the way I would have said it. So that encourages me. That doesn't mean I have to be like the most fully awake person in the entire world before I go out and say something about Buddhism. So that was important for me to read and study. All right, I'll go on for just a few more minutes. So there's another sutta on this same teaching. Now, this is the one where I think the more human part comes in a little more directly. So there's this monk. He's all, I won't go into where he was and what he was doing, but there's a description. And then he starts thinking about this this sutta, One Fortunate Attachment, but then he can't remember it completely. And how did it go? And then all of a sudden, a deity comes down from the heavens and lights up the whole surroundings. And this guy asks the deity, "Do you remember that sutta, One Fortunate Attachment? It was a really good one, but I just can't remember it." And then the deity says, "Yeah, you know, I know it was good too, but I don't remember it either." So people ask me, "Do you remember when Katagiri Roshi talked about this?" And I said, "No, I don't remember it. I was there, but I don't remember it at all." And it was probably because I was dozing off or drowsy or sleepy. So it's like, again, just as I said earlier, you know, you think if you're in the Buddha's giving a talk, you know, if we were to go back and actually be able to hear the Buddha, you know, we'd be wide awake listening. But if you were there at the time, maybe you were sleepy or drowsy, or, "Oh man, he's saying the same stuff again. I just heard this last." You might say that about some of our Zen teachers these days. They just keep saying the same thing over and over and over. So anyway, that's what I appreciate about that. And so actually, that's 32 minutes, so I'm gonna just stop there for a second. Well, more than a second. And just ask you if you have any comments about this or questions, or I usually say rebuttal too. You have some kind of rebuttal. So it's Steve, maybe you can watch closely to see. You can just raise your hand or do that little thing with the reaction, you know, with the hand. If you have a comment or question or anything like that, at least at this point. And
okay, it looks like we have a question from Ellen. Go ahead, Ellen.
I was just wondering, could you repeat the verse in the beginning again?
The stanza, the verse?
Yes, the stanza.
Yeah, sure.
Thank you.
"Let not a person revive the past or on the future build hopes, for the past has been left behind and the future has not been reached. Instead, with insight, let the person see each presently arisen state. Let the person know that and be sure of it, invincibly, unshakably. Today, the effort must be made. Tomorrow, death may come. Who knows? No bargain with mortality can keep it and its hordes away. But one who dwells thus ardently, relentlessly, by day, by night, it is that person the peaceful sage has said, who has one fortunate attachment."
Okay. I'm kind of curious, can you remind me what the translation for that Thich Nhat Hanh gave for that title? It was so different.
Yes. That's another thing. Thich Nhat Hanh wrote a whole well, it's a real little book, only 50 pages, but he wrote a book on this sutta too. So as it being one of the most important suttas in the Pali canon. And also he wrote one on, I was debating whether to talk about the sutta on developing full awareness of breathing. You know, a pretty mundane topic, but really a wonderful, wonderful sutta in my observation. It's called Our Appointment with Life. Our Appointment with Life. And if I, my exposition would mean our appointment with life is to just be here in this moment as it's arising. He also has a, like, I think that's the main title of the book. And then there's a subscript of The Better Way to Live Alone. So that's a little hard to, he gives a rationale about it, and it has to do with another sutta that contains the same message about someone who was living by himself in the forest. And I'm not recalling all the detail, but somehow Thich Nhat Hanh, because of his extensive knowledge and also of the Pali Canon and also of the Agamas, the Chinese Tripitaka, brought this together. And so he said a better way to live alone. So you can read the book. It's only 50 pages. Okay, so I did that, Our Appointment with Life.
We have one question from the room, Dokai.
Yeah.
It's from Mary.
My question is, when the Buddha said, with insight, let the person see, in the beginning of this quote, mm-hmm. What is the Buddha referring to? What's he saying there?
I think as it goes on earlier, it's with insight, what means we're not identifying. Now this gets a little tricky because, maybe some of you heard Byakken Rogier talk lately or read her book or something like that, but she's really emphasizing that sometimes that, well, we really do need to know if we're feeling angry or, you know, this is what's happening, and we just don't dismiss it prematurely. We dismiss it, but there's also another side where it's just arising right now, the anger. And if we say this, if we identify that I am this anger, that's not what insight is about. The insight is that it's arising, it's inside of me, but it's not me. It's just arising within me, and it'll change. So I think that's what he's saying when he says, I think you're asking about, instead with insight, let the person see each presently arising state. So insight is not identifying, like, this is my permanent condition. I'm angry, I'm depressed, and it's never going to change, something like that. So that's the insight. And yet it's not denying the fact, well, I'm sad, you know, that's what's arising right now. And that's what I'm feeling. But we know that it's just going to change. And does that help by answer your question?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you for your question.
Any other questions or comments from people?
I'd like to encourage you to go and read. You have to say something. I was going to talk about it, but I think I've said enough for today. Called There's No Escaping This Moment, by you'll find it. Well, I'll talk about 3 minutes. So it says there's no escaping this moment. When you sit in Zazen, how many beings sit with you? Right where you sit, many beings, emotions, thoughts, memory, physical sensation appear moment by moment. This is what he's saying when the Buddha is saying presently arising states. Yet this moment is very simple, so why not just take care of it with all your heart? But you can't. There are too many beings there, and they drag you away. Dragging you away, this is Kadigiri Roshi's language, but I think it relates to this is how you are vanquished or just taken away by these things that are arising. And of course, it's very extremely difficult. You know, we know that how we're just taken by it, if they're very, very challenging. On the other hand, look at your Zazen. Just something arising. That's really not so hard. It's just a little memory. But how are you like just kind of taken away with that story and just keep developing it and developing it and responding to it, creating it? We love to do that. You know, it's our own creation. We don't like to. It's kind of like an addiction, though. We have an addiction to thinking. That's my understanding of it. And so so you think of, you start to think of other things you could be doing, better things, things that would be better than just sitting here doing nothing. And so it's only your thinking that has gone off wandering, stumbling all over the beings of this moment. So he says even, but the idea of benefit is just another creature sitting there with you. And lastly, I'll say this moment is not the idea of this moment. If you see it as a concept, it becomes frozen. But the real moment is not frozen. Whatever we may think about this moment, our practice is just to return to it. This moment is where all beings exist, even though we have doubts and fears, even though we ask, why do I have to die? No answer appears. Only this moment is real. There's no escaping this moment. All beings, including doubt and fear, drop off in this moment. I've had experience of that. Sometimes I get really anxious. Like last night, I was kind of getting a little anxious about this talk. If I actually continue to think about it, I'll get more and more anxious. But if I just start breathing in and out, all the anxiety disappears. Well, I'm only concentrating on my breathing, right? Breathing in, breathing out, breathing in. Well, then that anxiety isn't there. So that's a way you can practice. And the Buddha really does emphasize that just breathing in, breathing out practice is, we really don't need a lot more than that. So, okay, well, thank you so much for your kind attention.
Thank you for listening. To hear more talks on Buddhism, Zen, and related topics, visit dharmafield.org.